John Lennon, born on October the 9th, 1940. His parents separated when he was quite young and he was brought up by his aunt. He went through the usual education course from primary school to Quarry Bank High School. But his mother still had quite an influence.
My mother played banjo, so, and I remember my granddad playing it when I was very young. You know? And she often played it if there was anything round, but there was never one round. You know, they'd all sold them in the hard times. And then I convinced her to buy me a guaranteed not to split guitar, you know, for £10, send away, and she got it me, and she taught me banjo chords. So on very early photos of the group, you see I'm playing funny chords on the guitar.
This guitar playing wasn't taken seriously by anyone.
It's a joke in the family now, you know, the guitar's all right for a hobby, that's the big thing, it's quite, but it won't earn you any money. I know that I always keep thinking that I should have, you know, I was obviously musical from very early, and I just wonder why nobody ever did anything about it. Because maybe because they couldn't afford it.
The lack of musical training didn't stop him getting together with some school friends to form the Quarrymen Skiffle Group. Another young musician joined up with John and his group. His name, Paul McCartney. Paul was born on the 18th of June, 1942. And from his primary school went on to the Liverpool Institute. His father plays piano, and Paul, oddly enough, started out on trumpet, but graduated to guitar later. He found a few problems with this, as he's naturally left-handed, but he soon mastered the instrument and became a competent vocalist, too.
He used to be sort of influenced by Elvis in the old days, I think. Just love him. Chuck Berry, yeah. Carl Perkins, and Marvin Gaye and things. Can't really sing like him, you know. I like him, though.
Among Paul's school friends was a younger musician who was reckoned to be one of the better guitarists in the area, George Harrison. George was born on the 25th of February 1943, and he too went to the Liverpool Institute.
At school I was a very bad pupil. In fact, I was, you know, probably one of the worst pupils they've ever had in the school. Yeah. But, you know, I realise that now. At the time, you know, I was all for having a good laugh, and if this hadn't have worked, then I don't really know what I would have been doing. Because I left school, I was an electrician for about, or apprentice electrician for about 4 months. And I decided, I remember asking my big brother, you know, would you pack in work and have a go at this if you were me? And he said, well, you know, you might as well, you never know. And he said, if you don't, you're not going to lose anything by, you know, just working in that job.
Rock and roll meant it was real. Everything else was unreal. To me, it got through. It was the only thing to get through to me out of all the things that were happening when I was 15, you know.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
You made me cry.
There was no such thing as an English record. I think the first English record that was anywhere near anything was Move It by Cliff Richard. And before that, there'd been nothing.
I must take a trip to California.
You'd listen to whatever was on the radio because the radio was the main thing in those days.
Gonna tell that Mary about Uncle John. He claimed he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun, oh baby.
I was listening to a lot of country and western then. Skiffle was coming through.
Freight train, going so fast. Freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone?
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well,
there were lots of people coming up then. And one of them was Buddy Holly. We loved his vocal sound and we loved his guitar playing. But most of all, I think, was the fact that he actually wrote the stuff himself. That's what turned us on.
When I went to art school, I was at art school for 5 years. When I went to, this is a sort of college, I went in there, they would only allow jazz to be played. You know, they wouldn't allow rock and roll in, it was frowned upon those days. So we had to con them into letting us play rock and roll there on the record player by calling it blues, you know.
As I became a teenager, I was about, I think, about 12 or 13 when I first heard Fats Domino, I'm in Love Again. That was the first, I think, what I would call the first rock and roll record I ever heard.
I remember being in school when I was a kid, and somebody had a picture in one of the musical papers of Elvis. I think it was an advert for Heartbreak Hotel. And I just looked at it and just thought, he's just so good looking. He just looked perfect.
When I was 16, Elvis is what was happening. A guy with long, greasy hair, wiggling his ass and singing Hound Dog and That's All Right Mama on those early Sun records, which I think are his great period.
That's him. That is the guru we have been waiting for. The Messiah has arrived.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine.
When I was 16, I re-established a relationship with my mother for about 4 years. She taught me music. She first of all taught me the banjo, and from that I progressed to guitar. The first song I learned was Ain't That a Shame, an old rock hit, Fats Domino.
When I was 13, 14, I used to be at the back of the class trying to draw guitars, big cello cutaway guitars with F-holes, little solid ones with pointy cutaways and rounded cutaways, and, you know, I was totally into guitars. And I heard about this kid who had a guitar, and it was £3.10. It was just a little acoustic, round, hole-type guitar. And I got the £3.10 off my mother. That was a lot of money in those days.
In fact, you know, sometimes we'd travel the whole of Liverpool just to go to someone who knew a chord we didn't know. Remember once hearing about a bloke who knew B7. Now, we knew E and we knew A. It was quite easy, but we didn't know B7. That was kind of the missing part of the link, the other chord, the lost chord. So on we got on the bus, trooped across Liverpool, changed a couple of buses, found this fella, and he showed us dum, 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 B7. We learned it off him, got back on the bus, went home to our mates and went, zing, got it.
Yeah, Paul and I used to just kind of get together, played a bit, but we were just schoolboys then. There was no groups involved till a little bit later.
George and I lived very near each other in Liverpool. So, in fact, we were just a bus stop away from each other. I'd get on the bus, and then the stop afterwards, George would get on. So being quite close in age, we'd sit together and we'd talk about stuff and that. In fact, he was, I think, about 1.5 years younger than me. That's quite a big age difference at that time. So I suppose I used to talk down to him a little bit, as you do to a sort of kid who's 1.5 years younger than him, when he's sort of 14 and a half and I'm sort of 16, you know. Might have been a failing of mine to tend to sort of talk down to him because I'd known him as a younger kid.
He was always about 9 months older than I. Even now, he's still 9 months older than me.
Paul met me the first day I did Bebopalula live on stage. And a mutual friend brought him to see my group called the Quarrymen.
I I had a mate at school who was called Ivan Vaughan, and we were born on exactly the same day in Liverpool, so we were great mates. And one day he said, do you want to come to the Wilton Village Fete? So I said, yeah, all right. So we went along one Saturday afternoon. I remember coming into the field where they had the fete, and just a bit over there, there was a wagon, and on the back of this, or a little stage or something, up on this stage, there was a few lads around, and there was one particular guy I noticed at the front, had a sort of checked shirt, sort of blondish kind of hair, a little bit curly, sideboards, looking pretty cool, and he was playing sort of one of these guitars, guaranteed not to crack, you know, not a very good one, but he was making a very good job of it, you know, and I remember being quite impressed. And he was doing a song by the Del Vikings called Come Go With Me. And the thing about it was, he obviously didn't know the words, but he was pulling in lyrics from blues songs. So instead of going, come little darling, come and go with me, which is right, he'd then go, down, down, down to the penitentiary. And he'd be doing sort of little stuff he'd heard on big Bill Brunsey records and stuff. So I thought, that's clever. He's pretty good. That was John.
And we met and we talked after the show, and I saw he had talent, and he was playing guitar backstage and doing 20 Flight Rock by Eddie Cochran.
Ooh, well, I gotta get over the record machine when it comes to rockin', she's a queen. We'll up to dance on a Saturday night. Oh, no more I can hold her tight.
But the thing I think impressed him most was I knew all the words.
I walk one, five, three, five, four. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more. On 12th, I'm starting to drag. 15 before I'm ready to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to rock. Well, call me up on the telephone. Said, coming over, baby, cause I'm all alone. Said, baby, you were mighty sweet, but I'm in bed with aching feet. This went on for a couple of days, but I couldn't stay wet. So I walked 1, 2, 5, 3, 5, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more. 12, I'm starting to save. 15, 4, I'm ready to drag. I get to the top, I'm too tired to rock.
I was the singer and the leader. I made the decision whether to have him in the group or not. Was it better to have a guy who was better than the people I had in, obviously, or not? And that decision was to let Paul in to make the group stronger. And I turned around to him right then on first meeting and said, do you want to join the group? And I think he said yes the next day. Now, George came through Paul.
I said, well, I've got this friend who's really good, you know. And they said, well, yeah, like what? You know, I said, well, he can play raunchy perfectly. Down, 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 down. And we all love that song. So we said, well, gotta try him out. Remember, we ended up on the top deck of a bus, empty, late night bus kind of thing, and just us there. And he said, go on, George, get your guitar out. Go on, you show him, man. I thought, you know. And he got it out. Down, 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 sure enough. Note perfect, raunchy. You're in.
First thing we ever recorded was That'll Be the Day, Buddy Holly song, and one of Paul's called In Spite of All the Danger. And somewhere, it might be around, it's in Liverpool somewhere, that record. That's the actual first recording we ever made.
Anything you want me to do, I'll be true to you.
And everybody hung around in this club in Liverpool called the Jacaranda, which was near the art school, near Paul and George's school, in the centre of Liverpool. And so we started hanging around there before we were really formed a band, you know, when there was just me, Paul and George.
We used to show up for gigs with just three guitars, and the person booking us would say, where's the drums then? And to cover this eventuality, we say, the rhythm's in the guitars.
We once tried to do this audition for Carol Levis. There was this guy, Carol Levis Discoveries, and the scam, what it was that, you know, everybody would go on an audition and then they'd pick out somebody out of the auditions. You say, OK, you, and they'd pick out about probably 20 different acts to go on. And they'd have an audience, and then they'd have the clapometer, and whoever won would go on into the final or come back next week. And it was just something that kept on going. We went in for one of those.
So we were going up on the train from Liverpool to Manchester, rehearsing what we were going to do. And only me and George had our guitars. I think John, he must have sold his or busted or something. He didn't have his with him.
OK, there's just the two of us with the guitars, and as it happened, it looked good because Paul was, like, left-handed and I was right-handed and still am. And John was in the middle, and, like, John stood there with a hand on each shoulder, you know, think it over, what you just said.
Ba, ba, ba. Me and George, John would do the lead, and we were also going to do Rave On. So we went, we did it, he put his arms around us and stuff, and it was OK. We didn't win, as usual. But I believe that day some unfortunate person in that theatre was relieved of his guitar.
One more member did start appearing on a regular basis, Stu Sutcliffe.
The famous stories were he sold his painting to John Moore exhibition or something like that.
So the question was, what do you do with 75 quid? So we said, you know, that happens to be exact amount it takes to buy a Hofner bass and... that'd be a great thing to spend the money. I said, no, I'm a painter. I've got to spend on paints and such like, you know. We said, no, Stu, really? And John and I kind of gave him quite a sort of persuasive argument that the best thing to do, obviously, was to buy this Hofner bass, which he did. He went and did that. And only trouble was he couldn't play it.
But it was better to have a bass player who couldn't play than to not have a bass player at all.
They entered one or two talent contests without much luck, but at least they were playing regularly at coffee bars and clubs around Liverpool. This was the year when Princess Margaret married Tony Armstrong Jones and Senator John F. Kennedy was elected President of the United States. The boys were perhaps more concerned over local events including their regular appearances at the coffee bar, the Jacaranda. The owner was Alan Williams, who'd used Stu Sutcliffe to organise the floats for the Liverpool Arts Ball.
Well, he approached me and he says, "Why don't you do something for us, Alan?" I said, "Well, how do you mean, who's us, sir?" You know, he said, "Well, John and Paul, we've got a group which we call the Beatles." So he told me the lineup of the group, and they hadn't got a drummer. I said, "Well, who's drums?" He said, "We haven't got a drummer." I said, "Well, you've got to have a drummer." Anyway, I said, "I'll try and fix you up with a drummer." And so there sort of started me off with the Beatles, and I got them local gigs for 10 bob a man and things like that. But they were so enthusiastic, which is missing now in groups. You know, those days the groups would work, say, from 9 o'clock at night, maybe till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, because they loved the music. And this is, I reckon, was the making of them.
Alan later went to Hamburg with some of the tapes of the Silver Beatles and other groups to try and get them work over there.
I told him that the groups were the best in England, and that they were very famous groups, and he could have them with tongue in cheek in those days, because the Beatles used to be working for 5 bob a night and 10 bob a night. I said, "It'll cost you £100 a week, plus my commission of £10.
The club owner he met was Bruno Koschmider. He subsequently came to England and met Alan Williams in the Two Eyes Coffee Bar in London.
Das war 1959-60. Wir hatten hier in Hamburg, in meinem Tanzlokal, das war ja ein
Jugend- The first group who Mr. Koschmider saw was a group around Tony Sheridan. And he quite liked him, and he told this manager that this is the type of group he was looking for.
The Beatles at that time were unavailable, but Alan Williams arranged for Tony Sheridan and another group he managed, Derry and the Seniors, to go to Koschmider's club in Hamburg, where they were a big hit. British Beat was proving to be good for business, and a few weeks later, Bruno Koschmider was on the phone to Alan Williams with an offer of work for another group.
So I approached the Beatles and asked them, would they do it? And they said, "Yeah, we'd love to do it, but we haven't got a drummer." The drummer which they had, which was Tommy Moore, I'd packed in, and the way he packed in was quite funny, actually. I'd got him booked in at this Grosvenor Ballroom over in Wallasey, and one night they were booked over there, and the phone went, and it was Stuart. Stuart was the spokesman. And he said, "Look, Alan," he says, "Tommy Moore hasn't turned up. We're still stuck in the Jacaranda." So I whizzed down, picked him up, and we went round to his house. We knocked on the door, and Tommy Moore's wife was in the bedroom. She shouted, "What do you want?" I said, "Where's Tommy? He's supposed to be playing. You can go and piss off, because he's not playing any more with you. We've had enough, you know." And he's got a job in Garston Bottle Works, you know, on the night shift. So we drove to Garston Bottle Works, and out came poor Tommy in his overalls. I said, "Well, you know, what are you doing, Tommy?" And he said, "Well, look, the missus won't have it," he says. So I said, "Oh, well, I understand, you know." So I said, "Well, you'll have to do that with a drummer, you know." Now, they'd sometimes played at this club in Haymans Green, which was owned by a Mrs. Best. And she had a son who was a drummer. And he sat in with the Beatles occasionally when they played there. And they said, "Alan, we've got a drummer." So we got a drummer now. And the lineup was George Harrison, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Stuart Sutcliffe, and the new arrival, Pete Best.
So the group's complete, the date is set, and Alan, his wife, an interpreter, assorted friends, and the five Beatles set off for Europe.